evidence rule 804, statements against penal interest are not excluded by the hearsay rule if the declarant is unavailable as a witness. But a declarant is not unavailable as a witness if his absence is due to the procurement or wrongdoing of the proponent to keep him from testifying. The Court of Appeals has now held that where the evidence showed the defendant and his family were involved in transporting the declarant out of the country, and in addition, made no effort to secure the declarant's presence at trial, the defendant failed to establish the witness was unavailable for purposes of Rule 804. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Quiterio Morrison, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina.
Joe, before we discuss that unavailability under Evidence Rule 804, there was another case where the defendant got a new trial. Well, I would say based on voluntary intoxication, but not exactly. Tell us about State versus Powell.
State v. Powell. Yeah, this is a case out of Robeson County. The facts in State v. Powell were that for about 2 months in early 2021, the defendant allowed a man named John Horton to live in his apartment until there was a dispute between them, and defendant told John Horton he had to leave. For a week after Horton vacated the apartment, he harassed defendant by beating on the door, yelling, threatening the defendant. On the evening of March 27th, 2021, defendant was intoxicated. He went outside to smoke a cigarette. Horton was outside in the backyard. He approached defendant and the two started a fist fight. The evidence apparently was that Horton was the one that started the fight by throwing the first punch. Defendant eventually gained control, punched Horton until he was unresponsive. Defendant then proceeded to stomp Horton in the face and returning to attack Horton after being pulled off at least three different times by a neighbor. Defendant said at the time that he wanted to kill Horton. Horton was severely injured as a result of this attack, and defendant was charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury. At trial, the defendant requested instructions on lesser included offenses. The trial court denied that request. After jury deliberations had begun, the jury asked for a definition of intent to kill and the term specific intent. The trial court gave the pattern instruction on intent generally. At some point later, the jury indicated it was deadlocked. The judge told the bailiff to take a printed copy of the pattern Allen charge to the jury, and then 30 minutes later, the jury returned a guilty verdict. The defendant was convicted of assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury. The trial court entered judgment, and the defendant appealed. On appeal, there were basically four different issues. I'm going to go through them quickly because the one about lesser included offenses ends up being the dispositive issue. Defendant first argued that the evidence was insufficient, one, to support an inference that his hands and feet were deadly weapons, and two, to show an intent to kill formed after premeditation and deliberation. With regard to the inference that the hands and feet were deadly weapons, the Court of Appeals cited a case called State v. Steen, which is the North Carolina Supreme Court, for the proposition that bodily appendages such as hands and arms can constitute deadly weapons depending on the manner and circumstances in which they are used. In this case, the Court of Appeals concluded that the evidence of the defendant's attack on the victim with his hands and feet resulting in severe injury was sufficient to support an inference that the defendant's hands and feet were deadly weapons. And then with regard to that second challenge, for assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, the state is required to prove a specific intent to kill, but it does not have to show premeditation and deliberation. Here, the Court of Appeals concluded that the evidence was sufficient to support an inference that the defendant had the specific intent to kill. It noted the violent nature and the extent of the defendant's attack and the defendant's specific statement to a neighbor that he wanted to kill the victim. There was another issue in the case. The defendant argued the trial court erred by allowing the state to question him about two prior convictions. This was evidence elicited on cross-examination. The prosecutor asked the defendant about these two prior convictions that he had that were more than 10 years old. Under Evidence Rule 609, for impeachment purposes, evidence of a prior conviction more than 10 years old is inadmissible unless the court determines that the probative value substantially outweighs the prejudicial effect. Here, the Court of Appeals observed that defendant's 1994 conviction for financial fraud was probative of his trustworthiness, and his 2010 conviction for assault on a government official was probative to rebut his claim of self-defense. So the Court of Appeals ultimately found no abuse of discretion in allowing evidence of those prior convictions, even though they were more than 10 years old, and it went on to say that even if that was error, any error was harmless given the other evidence in the case. Defendant also argued that the trial court made certain what the Court of Appeals called deliberation errors during the jury's deliberation. Defendant argued the trial court erred in responding to the jury's inquiry on the meaning of specific intent, made statements tending to coerce a verdict, and failed to give the Allen charge in open court. Regarding the instruction on intent, the Court of Appeals, assuming error, found the defendant failed to show a probable impact on the verdict. As to the statements alleged to be coercive, the Court of Appeals similarly found that the defendant failed to show a probability of a different verdict absent the statements by the trial court. And then with regard to the Allen charge, the Court of Appeals acknowledged that the trial court under statute is supposed to give any additional instructions in open court, and that it was error to give the Allen charge in writing, but it found, given the other evidence in the case, that error was not reversible here.
You know, Joe, this was one thing I found a little bit interesting on that Allen charge issue, because we've had a lot of cases where appellate courts have taken a dim view of statements made by the trial judge that seem like they are leaning on the jury. And I know they did not find these persuasive, but I think this is for that reason. This might be a good reference point for prosecutors or even for appellate attorneys. For example, that comment that the judge did make when the jury was back in the courtroom saying, we've got 4 days invested in this case. You know, we've had other past appellate cases where, you know, things telling the jurors stuff along those lines of, if you don't reach a verdict, we'll just have to do this over again. Or, you know, we've invested so much time and energy in this, that there have been other cases where if it was a little bit stronger than that, that they did find that to be sort of coercive. So I think this is a good example of not every reference to that is necessarily going to be fatal.
Well, that's true. But it's also something that's picked up by Judge Wood writing separately in a concurrence here that found that that failure to give the additional instruction in open court as required by General Statute 15A-1234 in Judge Woods's view also would have supported granting the defendant a new trial here. That statute is, she says, a statutory mandate, and that the failure to give the Allen instruction in open court also entitled the defendant to a new trial. That's not the route that the majority went here. The error that the majority found entitled the defendant was a new trial was based on the trial court's failure to instruct on lesser included offenses. The Court of Appeals noted that assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill inflicting serious injury is a specific intent crime requiring the state to show intent to kill. For specific intent crimes, voluntary intoxication, it noted, is a valid defense. The Court of Appeals reasoned, therefore, if there was evidence tending to show the defendant was voluntarily intoxicated to the extent he could not have formed a specific intent to kill, he would be entitled to an instruction on lesser included offenses. Here, there was evidence that the defendant was intoxicated during the assault. The Court of Appeals said that evidence of the defendant's intoxication, when viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant, created reasonable doubt the defendant had the specific intent to kill the victim. And as a result of that, the Court of Appeals concluded that defendant was entitled to an instruction allowing the jury to decide whether it unanimously believed, beyond a reasonable doubt, the defendant specifically intended to kill the victim.
Okay, but Joe, this is the part that I was trying to wrap my head around during the introduction, because we just did a couple of episodes ago about voluntary intoxication. And, the standard to get the jury instruction is so high, right? We have to show that the person's reason was entirely overthrown. And yet it seems like they're saying that this evidence of just what we would call, regular intoxication seems to be enough that it is error as to the lesser included, but it's different than the jury instruction?
Right. I think that peculiarity is maybe more apparent than real because it arises from the different burdens of proof that are involved in those two analyses, right? In order for a defendant to get an instruction on the defense of voluntary intoxication, I think the case law says something. He has to show that it was utterly incapable of forming the intent necessary for the offense. So it's a very high burden, very difficult for the defendant to get that instruction. The issue here, though, is when a defendant makes a specific request for lesser included offenses, the evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant. And that's something the Court of Appeals picks up on here. It says, of course, when viewed in the light most favorable to the state, the evidence demonstrates defendant knew exactly what he was doing and alcohol did not impair his ability to form the specific intent. However, it is our duty to view the evidence in the light most favorable to defendant when considering whether defendant was entitled to an instruction on a lesser included offense and allow the jury to assign weight to that evidence. And because that burden was lesser to get that instruction on the lesser included offense here, that was the error that the Court of Appeals found in this instruction. So ultimately, it awarded defendant a new trial based on the trial court's denial of his request for a form of assault with a deadly weapon that did not include specific intent to kill.
So then the second case we have up is State versus Watkins. This is also a case from the Court of Appeals on September 3rd of this year, a case out of Wake County. And this case is dealing with the probable cause or the nexus element for a search warrant. And then another one of these challenges, an as-applied challenge for a felon in possession offense. The facts of the case happened back on December 17th of 2018. Two of defendants' friends actually were the ones who went in and robbed the house of a mutual acquaintance and her husband. The couple and her little sister were present at the time. These armed and masked assailants came in, zip-tied the residents, dragged them into the kitchen so that they could then freely raid through the house. Throughout the robbery, one of the assailants is on the phone with someone who appears to be telling them to, you know, hurry up and get out of the house. Goes on for about 15 minutes. They steal several thousand dollars worth of cash and some portable valuables, as they're described, from the house, the most notable of those being a distinctive gold ring. And they then flee the scene in this old dark green Toyota Camry. The investigation ultimately leads back to the defendant primarily through two things. There's a trash bag in the house that comes back with a fingerprint of the defendant on it, but also this distinctive ring that was stolen. They put that out to the pawn shops. There's a call that comes in from one of those shops about that ring. So with that, they are able to identify the person who brought it in. They get the cell phone records for that person, who ends up also being the defendant, and they get the security camera video of him in there selling the ring. Those phone records confirm several calls between one of the assailants, Jackson, and defendant at the time of this robbery. They also pull up this other recent police report that involved the defendant from a few days prior, where the defendant and this one other person were slashed the tires on a victim's car, and they fled from that scene in this gray Honda Cross Tour. Now, the cars end up becoming relevant to this because based on DMV records where they're able to identify the relevant cars, including the defendant's, they get a search warrant to go look at the defendant's Honda. And inside the Honda, they discover a handgun that's wrapped up in a rag and stashed under the hood. Based on this evidence tying the defendant to the robbery, he's indicted for a number of charges. We'll talk about several of those. But prior to going to trial, he moved to suppress the evidence that was seized from the Honda, arguing that the warrant application relied on this stale information and did not supply sufficient probable cause under the federal and state constitutions. But that is denied by the trial court, and the case goes to trial. The jury finds the defendant guilty of obtaining property by false pretenses and possession of firearm by a felon. They deadlocked on the remainder of these charges. However, at the sentencing hearing for the two that he was convicted of, he enters into a plea agreement pleading guilty to the robbery and the burglary related to that robbery incident at the mutual acquaintance's house. And in exchange, the state does not pursue any of these other charges the jury was deadlocked on, as well as the habitual felon status charge. So like I said, there's two issues that are raised on appeal. And the first of those is related to the search warrant, arguing that there was insufficient probable cause tying whatever was offered in the warrant affidavit to actually lay a foundation or provide the probable cause to go back and search the car. You know, in other words, just because somebody's charged with, I don't know, you know, a drug offense and they own a car, that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to be able to go and search the car. And in making this argument, this defendant is relying on a case called State versus Lewis from the Supreme Court in 2019, arguing that the affidavit lacked sufficient facts to show probable cause for the search of the car. But the Court of Appeals doesn't really have a lot of difficulty distinguishing the Lewis case from what's going on in this case. You know, in Lewis, it really was just essentially that the defendant and an accomplice had committed some crimes, and these are the cars that belong to those people. But there was really nothing in the affidavit to directly tie them to the crime. But that's not what's going on here. They distinguish it by explaining that here, in this case, you know, there really is evidence tying the cars back to the defendant. For example, witnesses said that they saw these other two accomplices, Jackson and Johnson, get out of an old dark green Toyota Camry and then mask up before going into the residence to rob the victim. And so there was this nexus between the incriminating vehicle and then the actions in a similar manner to the Lewis defendant. So they felt like that was sufficient nexus to tie the car to the crimes. And so there was probable cause for the officers to go in there and do the search that they conducted on the car, finding that handgun that was offered into evidence.
Jonathan, can I just try to summarize what
Sure.
you said? Basically, the fact that a defendant is suspected of criminal behavior and the fact that the defendant has a car might not be enough for the officers to get a warrant to search the car. But where you've got some kind of evidence tying the criminal behavior to the vehicle itself, that it would appear to be, under this case, creating enough of a sufficient nexus to support a warrant for the vehicle. Is that fair to say?
I think so. And that's the difference they're drawing with that Lewis case that the defendant was relying on. They say the defendant misreads State v. Lewis. And in that making that comparison, the Court of Appeals in this case says, unlike with defendant here, the Lewis affidavit contained no specific link between the defendant and either the Nissan or the Kia to be searched upon its approval. It's not just because you committed a crime and, hey, you own a car, so we'd sure like to go look in your car and see if there might be something there. We need that nexus. We need that link, something specifically tying the defendant to the car. And, you know, I mean, as we say with any...
Well, not just the defendant, but also the criminal activity to the car, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
It helped here that this was the particular car that it was apparently used in the burglary and the robbery.
Well, so that's the thing. The car involved in the robbery was this green Toyota, but the car that was searched was the gray Honda. But other incriminating evidence linked the defendant to the cars and to the robbery. Plus, there's this tire slashing incident from a few days earlier, and the defendant fled the scene of that crime in a gray Honda. And then on top of that, the affidavit for the search warrant specified that they were talking about the gray Honda registered to the defendant, not just a gray Honda out there in the world. Like we always say with probable cause, right? Some, you know, reasonable probability that evidence of the crime would be found there. And so here, when it's directly being used in the crime and it's directly tied to the defendant, there's a sufficient basis for us to think there could be evidence of the crimes in those cars. So for prosecutors trying to get those kind of search warrants, I mean, you know, again, this is a robbery case, but this is the kind of thing we're going to deal with a lot, you know, drug cases or anything else. So it is important to think about that nexus for cars or phones or any of it. But the state had that here. The second issue that comes up is dealing with this felon in possession of a firearm. And the defendant is making an argument that, Joe, I think we've talked about in a couple of episodes here recently. You know, we talked about these recent cases, State v. Nanes and State v. Ducker, but the defendants are making both facial and as applied constitutional challenges to that statute that just says it is a crime for a person convicted of a felony to possess a firearm. Consistent with Nanes and Ducker, the Court of Appeals here has little difficulty in saying that the facial challenge is not going to survive, even in light of recent U.S. Supreme Court cases that we've had. But they say the North Carolina Constitution, you know, it recognizes and protects people's right to bear arms, but that people who have been convicted of felonies are not the class of law-abiding citizens that are protected by those rights. And so we move fairly quickly past that, consistent with Nanes and Ducker. And I mean, I would say until we hear something different, maybe from our state Supreme Court, I think that's pretty much where we are on the facial challenges to the felon in possession. But like in Nanes and Ducker, they will engage in this more specific as applied challenge, basically meaning even if the law itself might be constitutional, as applied to me, it's an unconstitutional deprivation of my rights. And to decide that issue, the court looks at these five factors that have been established by some other cases, State v. Britt, State v. Johnson. We have to look at these five factors specific to this defendant and decide whether it should or should not apply to him. Those five factors are, number one, the degree of violence or threat of violence involved in the felony convictions responsible for the possession of firearm by felon conviction at issue on appeal. Number two is the overall length of time between those felonies and now this felon in possession conviction. Number three, the defendant's history of a general law-abiding conduct prior to the felon in possession conviction that we've got in front of us. Number four, the defendant's history of responsible lawful firearm possession over the time period when his possession of firearms was lawful. And then finally, number five, the defendant's assiduous and proactive compliance with the felon in possession statute and the subsequent amendments. And Joe, what I found interesting about this case is in the ones we've looked at previously, pretty much on every element, it went in the state's favor. It was kind of a five for five that there, you know, that there was no real question here. And this is not that. As they go through these five factors for this case, the Court of Appeals says, you know, really one and two sort of lean in the defendant's favor. Number four is sort of neutral, and it's three and five that weigh in the state's favor. So what we're talking about, you know, one and two going in the defendant's favor, his prior felony was cocaine possession, and that standing alone doesn't really convey a significant degree of violence. And the second element was that his record prior to this incident, similar to number one, showed no intrinsically violent felony convictions since a long time ago, back when he was number 16. So those are sort of in his favor. Number four, they treat similar to number one and say it's kind of neutral or sort of a wash that he only had this single felony conviction for cocaine possession prior to his 2023 convictions. But then again, three and five, they lean more in the state's favor. The third one is they're saying that his history of law-abiding conduct following his convictions prior to the trial is anything but exculpatory because he has pleaded guilty to two counts of felony first-degree burglary, one count of felony robbery with a dangerous weapon, three of these charges for which a jury had just declined to convict him. So they're not going to weigh in on the strategy of that, they say. But, you know, this clearly shows an absence of law-abiding conduct on his part. And then fifth is that he did not in any way seek vindication, you know, by challenging the applicability of the statute to him until after he got caught for this new crime that, you know, evidently involved a firearm after his false pretenses conviction. So anyway, that's what I found interesting is this is really is a weighing out and balancing of these five factors that they have to do. But they say based on these considerations, the first and second Brit factors weigh in defendant's favor, while the fourth is neutral at most, but the third and fifth factors strongly weigh in the opposite direction. And so his as-applied challenge fails as well. So since the warrant had sufficient nexus and probable cause, and since the as-applied challenge was not met under the five Brit factors, they ultimately conclude no error and the conviction is affirmed. And then, Joe, that sets up that last case we talked about in the introduction.
Yeah, State v. Quiterio Morrison. This is a case out of Forsyth County, again, came down from the Court of Appeals on September 3rd. The facts were these. In May of 2021, Isaiah Mitchell and his girlfriend, Evelyn Avila Noyola, went to a bar in Winston-Salem where they saw a defendant and his friend, Kevin Cisneros. Cisneros apparently had briefly dated Evelyn sometime in the past. Mitchell and Evelyn went home around 1 a.m. Evelyn received a call from defendant's phone number. Mitchell answered the phone, had a verbal altercation with the caller, and then Mitchell left the residence with Evelyn's phone and basically was never seen again. Circumstantial evidence tended to show that Mitchell went to defendant's home where a defendant and Cisneros were waiting. Around 2 a.m., Mitchell was shot and killed with defendant's gun in defendant's driveway. Several hours later, defendant and Cisneros buried the body at a horse track in Yadkin County. Mitchell's vehicle was later found less than 2 miles from defendant's cousin's house. Defendant and Cisneros fled to Mexico. When he learned there was a warrant out for his arrest, defendant retained a lawyer, returned to North Carolina, and turned himself in. Cisneros apparently remains on the lam. In July of 2022, defendant was indicted for first-degree murder and concealing an unnatural death. The matter came on for trial by jury in January of 2024. Defendant testified that he and Cisneros left the bar around 2 a.m., went to the defendant's house. Defendant testified that Mitchell showed up and attacked him and that Cisneros shot defendant. On voir dire, defendant presented the testimony from his father, Giovanni Quiterio Olmedo. Defendant's father testified that Cisneros told him that defendant was not involved in the shooting. That evidence was kept out, excluded by the trial court, and that becomes the major issue on appeal. Defendant was convicted of first-degree murder under a theory of felony murder, with the underlying felony being armed robbery, and convicted of concealing an unnatural death, and defendant appealed. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant argued that the trial court erred by excluding Cisneros' statement under Evidence Rule 804. That rule states that if a declarant is unavailable, his statement may be admissible if the statement was, at the time of making, so far tending to subject him to liability that a reasonable person would not have made the statement unless he believed it to be true. That's the statement against interest exception. A statement tending to expose the declarant to criminal liability is not admissible in a criminal case unless corroborating circumstances clearly indicate the trustworthiness of the statement. That's another part of that same Evidence Rule 804. And then further down in Evidence Rule 804, you find that unavailability is shown if the declarant is absent from the hearing and the proponent of the statement has been unable to procure his attendance by process or other reasonable means. It goes on to say a declarant is not unavailable as a witness if his absence is due to the procurement or wrongdoing of the proponent of his statement for the purpose of preventing the witness from attending the trial or testifying. So there are a lot of parts and pieces there. The upshot is there's basically these 3 points upon which the trial court found that this evidence was inadmissible. First, it said defendant failed to show that the declarant was unavailable, both because he failed to make a sufficient showing that he had tried to procure Cisneros' attendance at trial, and also because defendant was somehow involved in Cisneros not being available. There was evidence showing that the defendant and his family had participated in defendant and Cisneros fleeing to Mexico. The other thing was that the trial court found that there were not those corroborating circumstances that clearly indicated the trustworthiness of the statement. The trial court ruled Cisneros' statement was inadmissible, one, because he was not unavailable, and two, because there was insufficient evidence of corroborating circumstances indicating trustworthiness. The trial court also found Cisneros was not unavailable because his absence was due to the procurement or wrongdoing of the proponent. His absence was due to the defendant and his family helping Cisneros flee to Mexico. Reviewing those kind of three different points, the Court of Appeals observed that the evidence tended to show the defendant and his family were involved in transporting Cisneros out of the country, and that evidence supported the finding that his absence was due to defendant's actions. The Court of Appeals noted that there was no evidence the defendant made any effort to secure Cisneros' presence at trial. Hence, it concluded, defendant failed to show a good faith effort to procure the declarant's attendance. With regard to that point, the Court of Appeals made a point of saying that the burden is on the proponent. Regardless of any efforts taken by the state or the federal government to extradite Cisneros from Mexico, the burden is on the defendant as proponent of the statement to show he has been unable to procure Cisneros' attendance. And there is no evidence in this case that the defendant had made any effort to actually get Cisneros back from Mexico to testify at his trial.
Joe, I thought that was sort of an interesting point. This is not like some of those other cases we've had where the state was denied under Rule 804 because I think we've got a case where the witness was deployed, for example, with the military, and we didn't even subpoena the person. We didn't make any kind of an effort to get him back. But this seems a little bit different because, like you said, reading from that Rule 804, that the proponent can also, what, rely on other reasonable means, for example. And that doesn't seem like a totally off-the-wall argument for the defendant to be arguing here. Look, the entire might of the United States government surely was doing everything they could to get this person back. The U.S. Marshals, whatever. You know, I mean, this is a guy charged with murder in a foreign country. And if they can't get him back, what else could I possibly do to get him back? But it seems like the Court of Appeals is saying, nevertheless, you had to make some effort to try or else you're not meeting this test.
Right, precisely. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Here, no evidence details any efforts defendant took to secure Cisneros' presence at trial, other than pointing to the state or federal government's unsuccessful attempts, even though defendant knew where in Mexico Cisneros had fled to, knew where in Mexico Cisneros had family, had stayed in Mexico with Cisneros for some time, and had a close relationship with Cisneros' family in North Carolina. Defendant was pointing to the unsuccessful efforts of the states and the feds to get Cisneros back, and the Court of Appeals said, look, you were the one that wanted him here. You didn't do anything, even though you had all this additional information that might not have been immediately available to the state or federal government. So applying that rule kind of as written, it said, look, when you didn't do anything to get your witness here, we're not going to find error in the trial court's finding that you haven't made a sufficient showing that that witness was unavailable. And then kind of buttressing that holding, the Court of Appeals also upheld the finding of insufficient corroborating circumstances indicating trustworthiness. It pointed out that Cisneros' father's testimony, this was a statement that had not been provided to police earlier in the investigation. It found that Quintero Olmedo was an interested witness. Defendant's father did not provide information to the police earlier, as I just said, and despite having an interest in doing so, over 2 years had passed since the statement was first allegedly made, and the statement was inconsistent with the other testimony in the case. Given those circumstances, the Court of Appeals found no error in the trial court's finding that there weren't those additional corroborating circumstances to indicate the trustworthiness of the statement. There was one other issue here, although it doesn't take up very much real estate in the Court of Appeals opinion. The defendant argued that the evidence was insufficient to show the underlying felony for felony murder, which was that armed robbery. The Court of Appeals found that there was evidence defendant committed armed robbery in the chain of events of the murder. Defendant's phone and Snapchat account were used to invite Mitchell to defendant's house. Mitchell was shot with defendant's gun, and then Mitchell's car and cell phone were taken to defendant's cousin's house. It pointed out that under the continuing transaction doctrine, those sequence of events doesn't have to be the robbery and then the killing. It could be the killing and then a robbery or the intent to kill formed before or after. And taken this whole sequence of events as one continuing transaction, the Court of Appeals found sufficient evidence that there was an armed robbery and that defendant committed it to support that conviction for felony murder.
And that seems like a pretty straightforward application of the case law we've got, right? I mean, whether they robbed the person and then killed them or killed them and then robbed them, either way, it's sort of all one incident.
Right. So long as there's not a great difference in time and in place, then you can use that continuing transaction doctrine to kind of cover all the associated crimes here. That's right. John, that's all the time we have for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Powell, where evidence of the defendant's voluntary intoxication warranted instruction on a lesser-included offense. State v. Watkins, finding a sufficient nexus between the defendant's car and the alleged criminal activity. And State v. Quintero Morrison, finding no error in the trial court's exclusion of a hearsay statement when the defendant failed to establish that the declarant was unavailable to testify. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We are coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in beautiful Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's a topic you'd like for us to cover, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu. That's jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org. That's jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Thanks, Joe. Sounds good. Hope it helped.